It's time for the Douglas Coleman Show. Mr. Smooth and Savvy is joined by guests from all walks of life. From the entertainment industry, to authors, to political and social commentators. The famous
and not so famous.
The controversial and the light and fluffy. We have it all. Now, here's Douglas Coleman.
Well, hello. How are you? Welcome to the Douglas Coleman Show. This is Douglas Coleman. As always, thank you for joining us. Nice to have you with us. We've got Sandra Brown here today. Sandra is an author extraordinaire. She has written 71 New York Times bestsellers, and there are over 80 million copies of her book, in print worldwide, and they have been translated into 34 languages. Her books have been made into TV movies, and she's held multiple positions in the literary thriller world. Her latest book, Thick as Thieves, is available now, and she tells us a little bit about that book and tells us a little bit about herself and about her process. It's a great interview. It's very fun. Thank you so much to Sandra for coming on the show and spending a few minutes with us. Nothing much new to report. The video edition show is going great guns, and we are busy, busy. We are booked all the way through mid-October, and then we have scattered bookings all the way to the end of December at this point. So we're very excited about it. Check it out on YouTube, Douglas Coleman Show VE. We've got 12 shows up now, and many more in the works coming soon. So we will be right back with Sandra Brown.
You're listening to Mr. Smooth and Savvy right here on the Douglas Coleman Show. We'll be right back after these commercial messages.
Hi there, this is Stuart Epps, record producer. This is my story about Elton John, working with him in those early years, going back to 1967 at Dick James, all the amazing tours, those first recordings, going through to Rocket Records. And it's an amazing story about his incredible rise to stardom and my part in that. So look forward to taking you on that journey. So here we go.
Yeah, and to order this great audio CD, please just email me at stuartepps@talk21.com. That's Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, Epps, E-P-P-S, at talk, T-A-L-K, 2-1 in figures, .com. StuartEpps@talk21.com. Email me and I'll give you all the details for buying this brilliant audio disc. Thank you. Bye.
DJC Music and DJC Productions are pleased to announce a brand new website. We have started a listing website for radio show hosts as well as potential show guests. This is a meeting site where hosts and guests can come together. Show hosts can list their show and types of guests they're interested in booking. Potential guests can list their talents, bio, accomplishments, or anything they feel makes them an interesting radio show guest. There are no recurrent payments, only a one-time $5 listing fee. Your listing will stay up until you decide to cancel. Previous guests of the Douglas Coleman Show are welcome to submit their guest listing free of charge. Go to radiohostsandguests.com. That's radiohostsandguests.com.
Tired of living in a culture of lies, fake news, and alternative facts? The Pro-Truth Pledge reverses the tide of lies by calling on politicians, and everyone else, to commit to truth-oriented behaviors. The pledge asks signees to commit to 12 behaviors that research in behavioral science shows lead to truthfulness, such as clarifying one's opinions and the facts, citing one's sources, and celebrating people who update their beliefs toward the truth. Private citizens who sign the pledge get the benefit of contributing to a more truth-oriented society. Public figures get more substantive rewards for signing the pledge in the form of positive media and public recognition. The pledge crowdsources the truth by asking volunteers to evaluate the statements of public figures who sign the pledge. Take the pledge demand that your elected representatives do so, and encourage your friends to take it at protruthpledge.org.
Are you an independent musician? How would you like to have your songs played on hundreds of radio stations just like the one you're listening to right now? Join MusicSubmit.com and we'll promote your music to radio stations and blogs in your genre. It's free to set up your account, and we guarantee your music will be considered for airplay by radio stations worldwide. Why not sign up today? It's free. MusicSubmit.com, radio promotion for indie musicians.
Hi, this is John Morgan, production supervisor for DJC Productions. You're listening to The Douglas Coleman Show.
Okay, please welcome to The Douglas Coleman Show, Sandra Brown. Hi, Sandra, how are you doing?
Hi, Doug, I'm fine, thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, I appreciate it. Just reading over your bio, very impressive. 71 New York Times bestsellers, wow.
That number shocks me, too.
And over 80 million copies of your book in print worldwide. Now, when they say in print, does that mean you've sold 80 million copies? Or does that mean, what does that mean exactly?
Well, I think it's a combination of sold and can be bought right now. So it's the number of copies that have been distributed and sold and continue to be. I'm very fortunate to have my books translated into over 30 languages, and if pressed, I couldn't even list 30 languages, so that to me is staggering. But with social media, I hear from people from all over the world, and that never ceases to amaze me. I'm always wondering, how can my book, you know, that's set in Deep East Texas, resonate with someone, you know, in Iceland. But I guess stories, people are always fascinated with stories. And so I'm very fortunate to have that many readers.
Oh, definitely. Now, are all your books set in Western societies, I guess is a good way to put it?
No, not necessarily. I live in Texas. I'm a native Texan, so a lot are set in Texas. But I also spend a lot of time in the Carolinas and that area, and Louisiana. So a lot of my books have been set there. But traditionally, in the South or in Texas, yes.
I think there is a fascination around the world with Texas. I think there's a lot of people, particularly in Europe and in the Far East, that have this sort of stereotype of Texas with the cowboys and the hats and the,
yeah,
you know.
Mm. Well, I don't ride a horse to work, but it is. And I've been asked this question before. Did growing up in Texas contribute to your storytelling? And I give an unequivocal yes. Because we're all born liars, and to be a fiction writer, you have to be an elaborate liar. And so I do think, because of the kind of the lore that Texas has, you know, people expect from us outlandish situations, outlandish characters, larger-than-life characters. And so I think that has contributed greatly to my storytelling.
Well, if you remember the show Dallas, that show was more famous in, in the UK than it was in the United States. More popular, I should say.
Absolutely.
So how did you get started with all this? You want to give us a little bit of your backstory?
Well, I didn't know I was going to write professionally. That was never on my radar, actually. But my dad was an editorial writer. My mom was an avid reader. Both were. And I have four younger sisters. So the five girls in our house were taught to read at an early age, and we were voracious readers, all of us. And then I got married. I was working in television as a contributor to a magazine show on the ABC affiliate in Dallas. And one day they came through and fired all of us. And so it was really, I had two children at the time, toddlers, And my husband said, you know, you don't have anything to do now. You've always said you wanted to write fiction. Are you going to keep talking about it, or are you going to try it? And I was in my early 30s, but I thought, yeah, you know, this is something I've always wanted to at least try my hand at. So I literally set up a card table in a spare bedroom and started writing down stories. I didn't really know that I could do it, but I had a desire to. I had a fire in my belly to try it. And so that's how I got started. And so I really thank that gentleman who fired me, because it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Sometimes it works like that. I mean, I've known people that lost their job and thought they were at the end of the road, and it was just the beginning of a new road that turned out to be a lot better.
Right.
Absolutely true. So what was your very first book that you had published?
My first book was a romance. It was for a line called Ecstasy that Bantam Doubleday Dell was publishing. And I'd had the owner of a bookstore read the manuscript, and which she had offered to do. And she called me when she finished. She said, you know, they're starting up a new line of romances. And I know the editor, and I'm going to tell her to look for your manuscript to read it, because I think this is exactly what she's looking for. And that's how I got published the first time. It was called Love's Encore. And when she called to buy the book and say, I want to buy your book, of course, I couldn't believe it. I was having, you know, heart palpitations. But she said, have you written anything else? And I said, I've just finished another. And she said, is it like this? And I said, yes, along the same line. She said, send it to me. And she bought that one 13 days later. Uh-huh. So I actually sold my first two books within 13 days of each other. And so for several years, I wrote romances under four different names for several different publishers. And then I started moving more into the mystery and suspense and the thrillers like I'm doing now.
So I'm just trying to do the math in my head.
I know. You're like, how old is she?
Well, not exactly. Not exactly. I wasn't trying to think how old you were. But I was trying to do the math in my head of how many books a year you would have to write to get to 71 books.
When I began writing the romances, and this was a hot market at the time. This was like in the early 80s. And America had just discovered all of these American women writers. Up to that point, Harlequin romances kind of had a monopoly. And so all of these American publishers were saying, hey, we've got a whole continent full of writers over here. And so the publishing houses started publishing them at a pretty brisk clip. And so I got in on the ground floor of a genre that was really burgeoning at the time. And so a lot of it was just fortune that I was in the right place at the right time with a product that was, you know, a hot market. And so I could write, they were shorter, they were series books in that they were all packaged alike. And they came out with four or six a month. And so I could do about five of those a year. And then I started, you know, wanting to, after I'd done so many, I probably wrote, you know, it was about 8 years worth. So it was about 40 books. And I started wanting to branch out. You know, I had done that. And I wanted to write for a larger audience. I wanted to cultivate readers from other genres. And wanted standalones. In other words, I wasn't part of a group. I was me, myself, and I. And so I started writing under my own name, which is Sandra Brown. And so that's when I made the move. But that number, a great portion of that number, about half of the books I've written, were actually romances that I was writing numerous ones a year.
There is a difference in the way that a fiction writer would write versus the way a nonfiction writer would write. And I think of it in my head as research versus creation. A nonfiction writer would have to do research, like doing a book report almost, or doing, you know, some kind of a report on a particular topic. Fiction is more like artistic in the sense that you're like a painter starting from zero and you're creating something from nothing, or a songwriter. So for you, what is your process? I mean, does something have to inspire you to, oh, there's an idea, and then you get developing it and building it and building it? Or do you do it more like a 9-to-5 in the sense that you say, okay, Monday morning, 9 o'clock, I'm sitting at the computer, I'm starting to write, even if you might not know what it is you're going to write?
It might be, it's kind of a combination between the two. It's definitely my job. I always, from that very beginning, when I set up that card table, I thought, I'm not going to dabble in this and say, well, I'm writing a book, and have everybody snicker behind their hand and then not produce. I was determined. And so I approached it, even though I had these, you know, babies crawling around, approached it as a job. And I would go to work every day. So I still have that discipline. And I think because my dad was an editorial writer and he had to write something for the newspaper every day. So that discipline I witnessed, you know, the whole time I was growing up. You start from scratch, you've got to come up with something. And so it is a job. I do approach it as a job. I think if most writers waited to get inspired, they'd never sit down at the computer, you know, a lot of it. But when an idea takes hold, and when I've got a plot in mind and the characters start breathing down my neck, then I'm ready to sit down and start writing their story. It is a creative process. I come up with a basic idea and hope that it wants to be a story. Not all ideas do. They'll just lie there and never develop. But I know that I have one when I get what I call the aha. And the aha is the one thing that I know that the reader doesn't know. And when I get that, then I think, this idea wants to be a story. That's the reason I'm going to write this book, is because I'm going to be asking them a question, planting a question in their mind on the first page if possible, and I'm not going to answer it until the last page if possible. So that question is always there in the back of their mind. It's the great lie that I'm telling. And when I get that, then I know that, okay, there's a plot here. It wants to be a book. So I have a direction, and I will build in several spikes along the way, changes of direction, a twist here, a revelation there. So I know where I'm going, but I don't know how I'm going to get there. And that's what makes it fun, is that some days I sit down at the computer, I have no idea what comes next. And after I wrote the prologue for Thick as Thieves, I really liked the prologue, had no idea who those people were, where they were, what their connection to each other were, except for the bag of stolen money at their feet. I just started writing a scene. I was just there with them, and I heard them talking. So I wrote it down, and by the end of, you know, 6 or 7 pages, I had a prologue, and I thought, gosh, who are these people, you know, and what's going on, and how does everything go from a successful heist to so bad in such a short period of time? So I sent it to my editor, and he was like, oh, I love it. He said, what comes next? And I said, I have no idea. But I had 450 pages to fill. So I had to, you know, come up then with the rest of the story. And so in a way, I don't feel as though I create so much as I excavate.
Well, that's a good way to put
it. The story is always there, and it's up to me to pull it out.
How many times have you surprised yourself in the sense that you started out with this idea, and then when you got to the end of it, it was nothing like what you thought it was going to be?
It's not when I get to the end of it, but I have so many times. I mean, my characters are a lot smarter than I am, and they're busy at work when I'm sleeping. I often wonder what they're doing while I'm not there. You know, if I'm in the middle of a book and I'm writing it, but I have to take, you know, an afternoon off to do something, I'm antsy because I'm thinking, what are they doing while I'm not there? I know it's totally schizophrenic. But I haven't surprised myself at the end of a book, but one time, just one time. But I have surprised myself in the middle of a book, and one of those spikes that I was talking about, or one of those twists, I wouldn't see coming. And then it would be like, oh, gosh, I'm good. You know? But it would be like, I'd sit there and go, I can't believe that just happened. So it would be something that I hadn't even thought about, but that's why I say my characters are smarter than I am. They figured it out while I was doing something else.
It's a pretty good feeling, isn't it, when you do that, when you sort of outsmart yourself?
Yeah, I wish it happened more often.
I want to hit on one of the talking points that your PR person sent. What would your readers be surprised to learn about you?
They would be very surprised to know how much I mistrust the success, how impermanent I feel like it is, even though I've been doing this for almost 40 years. I never trust it. And every day when I go to the keyboard, I'm terrified that whatever talent I had or fooled people into believing that I had has disappeared in the night. It's vanished. It's gone. I can't do this anymore. I don't know how to do this. And I will drive my husband crazy, my kids crazy, my friends crazy, agonizing, just agonizing. I can be in the middle of a book, get stuck, you know, on something, and sit for days, you know, just banging my head against the wall thinking, why can't I figure this out? I know how to do this. And I look at the wall of books, at bookshelves in my office. I'm like, I wrote all those words. I wrote all those stories. I developed all those characters. I know how to do this. And yet it seems like it's deserted me. Eventually it sorts itself out, fortunately, and I'm knocking on wood right now. But I think that the fear is a healthy thing in a way. I think that it's a motivator, and I think that it keeps me from getting lazy and predictable. I think that constant nagging insecurity makes me want to do it over and over and over again, for no one else, to prove to myself that I can. So I don't think that, you know, that a reader looking in or looking out at me would see that. I don't necessarily project it when I'm in public, but that would be the thing I think that would surprise them, is that after all these books, you still get nervous about writing it? Yes, I do.
Do you ever see yourself retiring? And like you get to the one book
all the time
and say, this is the last book, you know.
The answer is, retire to do what?
Well, that's a good question.
There's nothing that I enjoy doing more than I enjoy the writing. It's a love-hate relationship for sure, and it does drive me crazy, and consequently I drive other people in my life crazy. I just can't see the day that I wake up and go, no, I don't want to do that anymore. I may not have a story idea, but when I finished Thick as Thieves, and we had COVID, and so I had nothing else to do but stay indoors in my house, in my jammies like everybody else, and wander from room to room. But what I did was just start reading. Because I'm a reader first. Before I was a writer, I was a reader, and I still am. I read everything. And so I just feasted on books, read one right after another. And after a few weeks, I kind of got, you know, energized. It was like, I'm really anxious to get back into another story. So it, in a way, the writing grounds me. I've lived a life like everyone else and had disappointments and heartaches and lost people that I love dearly and gone through illnesses with them and so on and so forth. So life has definitely gotten in the way. But the writing, rather than, you know, being something, the drudgery that I had to go through, the writing was always kind of an escape from what was going on in my life at the time. You know, if it was terrible, I could fall back on the writing, and it provided, you know, it kind of grounded me. So I don't see a time in my life, although it may happen. I may wake up one morning and go, no, I'm just not going to do that anymore. But I can't feature it. I can't feature what life would be like if I didn't have it.
Your latest book is called Thick as Thieves. You want to give us just a quick summary of that book?
Well, it's four burglars who pull off a successful theft, and they have a plan, but it goes awry. And actually, that's the backstory. The present-day story takes place 20 years later in present day. And they're still coping. Their sins are finding them out. It was really two stories in one. I had to write the backstory in snippets, sections. I kept them brisk. I kept them short. But they had to be as vital as what is the present day story, because what happened then and how everything fell apart and collapsed had to be as interesting as what was happening in the present day. So it was a real challenge. So it's kind of like, you know, two stories in one. It's what happened then and how it's affecting things, the consequences that everybody's facing about it now.
Okay. The book came out. When did the book come out?
Today.
Oh, today?
August 25th.
Uh-huh. Oh, all right.
Today.
It didn't say on this sheet when it was coming out. So, well, that's good
timing,
isn't it?
Oh, great. Where's the champagne?
Well, super. Then the timing of this interview was good as well.
Perfect.
We do have to wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming on. What is your website so people can come check it out?
It's sandrabrown.net or .com. They can find me. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, so I'm pretty easily found, but sandrabrown.net is my website, all lowercase, and I hope the listeners will be intrigued and want to read Thick as Thieves.
Well, super. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This was very fun talking to you. Best of luck. I hope
Thank you, Douglas. The
book does as well as all your other books do.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.